Epilogue. For days after the landing, the hull creaked and echoed from the lower depths as it adjusted to the external pressure of the ocean. Now and then, without human bidding, servitors scurried into the bilges to repair hull leaks where the seawater was surging in. The ship rocked ominously from time to time, but gradually anchored itself until it began to feel less like a temporary addition to the landscape than a weirdly hollowed-out geological feature, a silver-thin stack of morbidly weathered pumice or obsidian, an ancient natural sea tower wormed with man-made tunnels and caverns. Overhead, silver-grey clouds only occasionally ripped apart to reveal pastel blue skies. It was a week before anyone left the ship. For days, shuttles wheeled around it, circling it like nervous seabirds. Although not all the docking bays had been submerged, no one was yet willing to attempt a landing. Contact was, however, re-established with the teams who had already landed on the juggler world, and who had made the descent from the surface. Makeshift boats were sent across the water from the nearest island, a distance of 15 kilometers only, until they kissed against the sheer-sided cliff of the ship. Depending on tidal conditions, it was possible to reach a small human-only airlock. Clavain and Falco were in the first boat to make it back to the island. They said nothing during the crossing as they slid through wet grey mist. Clavain felt cold and despondent as he watched the black wall of the ship fall back into the fog. The sea here was soup thick with floating microorganisms. They were on the very fringes of a major juggler biomass focus, and the organisms had already begun to plaster themselves against the side of the ship above the waterline. There was a scabby green accretion, a little like verdigris, which made the ship look like it had been here for centuries. He wondered what would happen if they could not persuade Nostalgia for Infinity to take off again. They had 20 years to talk it into leaving. But if the ship had already made up its mind that it wanted to stay rooted here, he doubted very much that they would be able to persuade it otherwise. Perhaps it wanted a final resting place, where it could become a memorial to its crime and the redemptive act that had followed. "Clavain," Falco said. He looked at her. "I'm all right." "You look tired. But we need you, Clavain. We haven't even begun the struggle yet. Don't you understand? All that's happened so far is only the beginning. We have the weapons now."
"A handful of them, and Skade still wants them."
"Then she'll have to fight us for them, won't she? She won't find that as easy as she imagines."
Clavain looked back, but the ship was hidden. "If we're still here, there won't be a lot we can do to stop her."
"We'll have the weapons themselves. But Remontoir will have returned by then, I'm sure of it. And he'll have Zodiacal Light with him. The damage wasn't fatal. A ship like that can repair itself."
Clavain tightened his lips and agreed.
"I suppose so."
She held his hand as if to warm it. "What's wrong, Clavain? You brought us so far. We followed you. You can't give up now."
"I'm not giving up," he said. "I'm just tired. It's time to let someone else carry on the fight. I've been a soldier too long, Falco."
"Then become something else."
"That's not quite what I meant."
He tried to force some cheer into his voice.
"Look, I'm not going to die tomorrow or next week. I owe it to everyone to get this settlement off the ground. I just don't think I'll necessarily be here when Remontoir makes it back. But who knows? Time has a nasty way of surprising me. God knows I've learned that often enough."
They continued in silence. The crossing was choppy, and now and then the boat had to steer itself past huge seaweed-like concentrations of ropey biomass, which shifted and reacted to the boat's presence in an unnervingly purposeful way. Presently Clavain sighted land, and shortly after that the boat skidded to a halt in a few feet of water, bottoming out on rock. They had to get out and wade the rest of the way to dry land. Clavain was shivering by the time he squelched out of the last inch of water. The boat looked a long way away, and Nostalgia for Infinity was nowhere to be seen at all. Antoinette Bax came to meet them, picking her way carefully across a field of rock pools that gleamed like a tessellation of perfect grey mirrors. Behind her, on a higher rising slope of land, was the first encampment, a hamlet of bubble tents stapled into rock. Clavain wondered how it would look in 20 years.
More than 160,000 people were aboard Nostalgia for Infinity, far too many to place on one island. There would be a chain of settlements instead, as many as 50, with a few hubs on the larger, drier nubs of land. Once those settlements were established, work could begin on the floating colonies that would provide long-term shelter. There would be enough work here to keep anyone busy. He felt an obligation to be part of it, but no sense that it was anything he had been born to do. He felt, in fact, that he had done what he was born to do. "Antoinette," he said, knowing that Falco would not have recognized the woman without his help. "How are things on dry land?"
"There's shit brewing already, Clavaine."
He kept his eyes on the ground for fear of tripping. "Do tell. A lot of people aren't happy with the idea of staying here. They bought into Thorne's Exodus because they wanted to go home, back to Yellowstone. Being stuck on an uninhabited pissball for 20 years wasn't quite what they had in mind." Clavaine nodded patiently. He steadied himself against Felka, using her as a walking stick. "And did you impress on these people the fact that they'd be dead if they hadn't come with us?"
"Yes, but you know what it's like. No pleasing some people, is there?"
She shrugged.
"Well, just thought I'd cheer you up with that, in case you thought it was all going to be plain sailing from now on."
"For some reason, that thought never crossed my mind. Now, can someone show us around the island?"
Felka helped him pick his way onto smoother ground.
"Antoinette, we're cold and wet. Is there somewhere we can get warm and dry?"
"Just follow me. We've even got tea on the go."
"Tea?"
Felka asked suspiciously. "Seaweed tea. Local. But don't worry, no one's died of it yet. And you do eventually get used to the taste."
"I suppose we'd better make a start," Clavaine said.
They followed Antoinette into the huddle of tents. People were at work outside, putting up new tents and plumbing in snake-like power cables from turtle-shaped generators. She led them into one enclosure, sealing the flap behind them. It was warmer inside and drier, but this served only to make Clavaine feel more damp and cold than he had a moment before. 20 years in a place like this, he thought. They'd be busy staying alive, yes. But what kind of life was one of pure struggle for existence? The jugglers might prove endlessly fascinating, awash with eternally old mysteries of cosmic provenance, or they might not wish to communicate with the humans at all. Although lines of rapport had been established between humans and pattern jugglers on the other juggler worlds, it had sometimes taken decades of study before the key was found to unlock the aliens. Until then, they were little more than sluggish vegetative masses, evidencing the work of intelligence without in any way revealing it themselves. What if this turned out to be the first group of jugglers that did not wish to drink human neural patterns? It would be a lonely and bleak place to stay, shunned by the very things one had imagined might make it tolerable. Staying with Remontoir, Curry and Thorne, plunging into the intricate structure of the living neutron star, might begin to seem like the more attractive option. Well, in 20 years they'd find out whether that had been the case. Antoinette pushed a mug of green-colored tea in front of him.
"Drink up, Clavaine."
He sipped at it, wrinkling his nose against the miasma of pungent, briny fumes that hovered above the drink.
"What if I'm drinking a pattern juggler?"
"Felka says you won't be. She should know, I think. I gather she's been itching to meet these bastards for quite a while, so she knows a thing or two about them." Clavaine gave the tea another go.
"Yes, that's true, isn't it?"
But Felka had gone. She had been in the tent a moment ago, but now she wasn't.
"Why does she want to meet them so badly?"
Antoinette asked.
"Because of what she hopes they'll give her," Clavaine said. "Once, when she lived on Mars, she was at the core of something very complex, a vast living machine she had to keep alive with her own willpower and intellect. It was what gave her a reason to live. Then people, my people, as a matter of fact, took the machine away from her. She nearly died then, if she had ever truly been alive. And yet she didn't. She made it back to something like normal life. But everything that has followed, everything that she has done since, has been a way to find something else that she can use
and that will use her in the same way. Something so intricate that she can't understand all its secrets in a single intuitive flash, and something that, in its own way, might be able to exploit her as well. The jugglers, still clasping the tea, and it wasn't so bad, really, he noted. He said, yes, the jugglers. Well, I hope she finds what she's looking for, that's all.
Antoinette reached beneath the table and hefted something up from the floor. She placed it between them, a corroded metal cylinder covered in a lacy froth of calcified microorganisms. This is the beacon. They found it yesterday a mile down. There must have been a tsunami which washed it into the sea. He leaned over and examined the hunk of metal. It was squashed and dented like an old rations tin that had been stepped on.
It could be conjoiner, he said, but I'm not sure. There aren't any markings which have survived.
I thought the code was conjoiner.
It was. It's a simple in-system transponder beacon. It's not meant to be detected over much more than a few hundred million kilometers. But that doesn't mean it was put here by conjoiners. Ultras could have stolen it from one of our ships, perhaps. We'll know a little more when we dismantle it. But that has to be done carefully.
He wrapped the rough metal husk with his knuckles.
There is antimatter in here, or it wouldn't be transmitting. Not much, maybe, but enough to make a dent in this island if we don't open it properly.
Rather you than me. Clavaine. He looked around. Felker had returned. She looked even wetter than when they had arrived. Her hair was glued to her face in lank ribbons, and the black fabric of her dress was tight against one side of her body. She should have been pale and shivering, by Clavaine's estimation, but she was flushed red, and she looked excited.
Clavaine, she repeated.
He put down the tea.
What is it?
You have to come outside and see this. He stepped out of the tent. He had warmed up just enough to feel a sudden spike of cold as he did so, but something in Felker's manner made him ignore it, just as he had long ago learned to selectively suppress pain or discomfort in the heat of battle. It did not matter for now. It could, like most things in life, be dealt with later, or not at all. Felker was looking out to sea.
What is it? He asked again.
Look. Do you see? She stood by him and directed his gaze. Look. Look hard. Where the mist thins out.
I'm not sure if...
Now.
And he did see it, if only fleetingly.
The local wind direction must have changed since they had arrived in the tent, enough to push the fog around into a different configuration and allow brief openings that reached far out to sea. He saw the mosaic of sharp-edged rock pools, and beyond that, the boat they had come in on, and beyond that, a horizontal stroke of slate-gray water which turned fainter as his eyes skidded toward the horizon, becoming the pale milky gray of the sky itself. And there, for an instant, was the upright spire of Nostalgia for Infinity, a tapering finger of slightly darker gray rising from just below the horizon line itself.
It's the ship, Clavaine said mildly,
determined not to disappoint Felker.
Yes, she said, it's the ship,
but you don't understand. It's more than that. It's much, much more. Now he was beginning to feel slightly worried.
It is.
Yes, because I've seen it before.
Before?
Long before we ever came here, I saw it. She turned to him, peeling hair from her eyes, squinting against the sting of the spray. It was the wolf, Clavaine. It showed me this view when Skade coupled us together. At the time, I didn't know what to make of it, but now I understand. It wasn't really the wolf at all. It was Galliana, getting through to me even though the wolf thought it was in control. Clavaine knew what had happened aboard Skade's ship while Felker was her hostage. He had been told about the experiments and the times when Felker had glimpsed the wolf's mind. But she had never mentioned this before.
It must be a coincidence, he said, even if you did get a message from Galliana. How could she have known what was going to happen here?
I don't know, but there must have been a way. Information has already reached the past, or none of this would have happened. All we know now is that somehow our memories of this place, whether they're yours or mine, will reach the past.
More than that, they will reach Galliana.
Felka leaned down and touched the rock beneath her.
Somehow, this is the crux, Clavain. We haven't just stumbled on this place. We've been led here by Galliana, because she knows that it matters that we find it.
Clavain thought back to the beacon he had just been shown.
If she had been here...
Felka completed the thought. If she came here, she would have attempted communion with the pattern jugglers. She would have tried swimming with them. Now, she may not have succeeded, but just supposing she did, what would have happened?
The mist had closed in completely now. There was no sign of the looming sea tower.
Her neural patterns would have been remembered, Clavain said,
as if speaking in a dream.
The ocean would have recorded her essence, her personality, her memories, everything that she was.
She'd have left it physically, but also left behind a holographic copy of herself in the sea, ready to be imprinted on another sentience, another mind.
Felka nodded emphatically, because that's what they do, Clavain. Pattern jugglers store all who swim in their oceans.
Clavain looked out, hoping to glimpse the ship again.
Then she'd still be here.
And we can reach her ourselves if we swim as well. That's what she knew, Clavain. That's the message she slipped past the wolf.
His eyes were stinging as well.
She's a clever one, that Galliana.
What if we're wrong?
We'll know. Not necessarily the first time, but we'll know. All we have to do is swim and open our minds. If she's in the sea, in their collective memory, the jugglers will bring her to us.
I don't think I could stand for this to be wrong, Felka.
She took his hand and squeezed it tighter.
We won't be wrong, Clavain. We won't be wrong.
He hoped against hope that she was right. She tugged his hand harder, and the two of them took the first tentative steps towards the sea. This concludes Redemption Arc. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks, and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.